My name is Sunday Goshit. I am an ICFRC board member and your host for today's program. And as a reminder, we plan for this program to go until 7 p.m. Maybe before we continue, I want to call on Marvin to tell us something about the QR codes that we have on the tables there, the little QR codes. Marvin?
My name is Marvin Ojo, and the QR codes you have on the table is from Aerie, and Aerie is a local-based platform that Delta Equity Capital, a fund I run, is funding. And the deal is, if you scan the QR code and capture a moment here, ICFRC gets a donation of $1 for each moment captured. And for every reaction, they get another dollar. So have fun with it.
Okay. I think the most important part of this is the fact that it helps in community engagement and helping more people to know about the programs and what we do in ICFRC and generally in the community. So today is our eighth program in our spring 2025 lined up. We are also in the middle of our four-part series, The Changing Environment, Adaptation, Resilience, and Sustainability, of which today's session is the final part. More information about the series is available on our website on the tables. We're deeply grateful for the long-standing support from our community. Your help has allowed our organization to grow for 41 years, hosting speaker programs with experts joining us in person and online from across the world. As a small nonprofit, we exist because of the generosity of individuals like you, and we head into 2025 opportunities. As we head into 2025, opportunities for nonprofit funding beyond individuals is becoming more difficult as charitable organizations like ours face an uncertain future, especially when focused on uplifting research and stories advocating for marginalized, vulnerable, and international communities. Please consider donating by cash or check with the QR code on our table in the hallway or online to keep our free educational programs available over the next year. ICFRC would like to give a heartfelt thank you to today's sponsors and partners, including Frontier Co-op and UI's Anthropology Department, Office of Sustainability and the Environment, Center for Human Rights, International Programs and International Studies, as well as 100 Grannies, Newman Monsoon Architects, and Midwest One Bank, and the one that was just explained to you today. And of course, the Iowa City Public Library for providing partnership, space, and today's food. And if you've not gotten some pizza, yes, please, go ahead. Thank you all for your support. Our next program will be on Thursday, May 1st of May at 6:30 p.m. in the Schomburg Auditorium in the UI Main Library. And this program is titled Reclaiming Heritage, Leadership in Restitution and Repatriation in Iowa. Join us for a thought-provoking and timely panel discussion featuring esteemed representatives from the Stanley Museum of Art, the Pentecost Museums, and the Office of the State Archaeologist. Together, they will explore the University of Iowa's leadership and evolving practices in the restitution and repatriation of African and indigenous American cultural objects. This conversation sheds light on the critical role of institutions in addressing how objects become part of institutional collections and fostering meaningful dialogue about cultural heritage and accountability. As the opening event of the three-day Mellon-funded symposium, this session invites you to engage with experts at the forefront of this transformative work, setting the stage for deeper reflection and action. Please see our website, icfrc.org, for the rest of this spring's programs. Now I would like to go ahead and introduce our speakers for today. Alicia Simmons is the Senior Sustainability Manager at Frontier Co-op in Norway, Iowa. In this role, she leads environmental stewardship efforts across the cooperative, including managing the zero waste program and the initiatives related to packaging and EPR, energy and emissions, and the natural resource usage. Since joining Frontier Co-op in 2017, Alicia has also directed the co-op's corporate citizenship, including their annual giving programs, which exceed $1 million in grants each year, supporting community building projects in sourcing regions, partnering with local nonprofits to reduce employment barriers, and managing two signature giving programs focused on women empowerment and food security. Alicia oversees the co-op's global giving and community-based partnerships around the world, including recently a three-year, $1 million project in rural India that established the region's first farmer-owned tea collective. As a complement to her work, she also leads the co-op's communication and public relations. Beyond her professional role, Alicia is a committed advocate for sustainability and social responsibility, holding leadership positions with organizations such as the Indian Creek Nature Center, Iowa Sustainable Business Forum, and the Iowa Area Community Action Program. She holds a BA from the University of Iowa and an MBA with a quality emphasis and Master Strategic Leadership from Mount Mercy University. I thought this must be a Hawkeye. Great. Dr. Amy Colbert is a professor of management and entrepreneurship in the TB College of Business and a University of Iowa Distinguished Chair. She earned a PhD in organizational behavior and human resource management from the University of Iowa, a master's degree in decision sciences from St. Louis University, and a BS in accounting and mathematics from Culver Stockton College. Amy's research focuses on the ways in which individuals connect with their work, their co-workers, and their organizations in ways that motivate and sustain them. She also studies the factors that contribute to effective leadership and the mechanisms by which leaders achieve results. Finally, she's interested in how identity and identity transitions shape beliefs and decisions. Amy has published scholarly articles on these topics in top journals and writes about research and her own experiences in her Substack column, Who Am I Now? Amy teaches courses on leadership to MBA, executive, and PhD students. She served as Department Executive Officer for Management and Entrepreneurship for 4 years and is currently the Faculty Director of TP's Social Impact Community, a hub for faculty, staff, and students who are interested in the ways that business can make a positive impact on society. Wow. Okay, please join me in welcoming these amazing two people who are going to speak to us today. And I will hand over to you.
Good evening. It's so good to be here with you tonight. I have had the pleasure in my role as a professor of management at the Tippie College of Business, and especially in my role as the head of the social impact community, in working with Frontier on several different projects. The most recent one was writing a case study of some work that they have done across the globe that inspired me. I wrote about this over the summer and was willing to put in lots of hours learning about what they were doing because it was both inspirational, but also seemed to align with the direction that I hope more of the world is going. And so it's been fun to partner with Alicia on lots of things, including this. Alicia, thanks for being here tonight.
Yes, of course. Thank you all for having me. It's funny, yeah, anytime I get an email from Amy asking if I want to come do something with the university, it's always a yes for sure because, yeah, it's been such a good partnership for so long. So, yes, as mentioned, I'm Alicia Simmons. I'm the Senior Sustainability Manager for Frontier Co-op. We are a manufacturer of natural and organic spices and herbs and flavorings, and we do a personal care brand as well, which I'll go through all that in a minute. But basically, a senior sustainability manager, anything that's good, you heard the intro, like anything that's good for people or planet or how we talk about it, I get to have my hands on. So it's a pretty good gig. I recommend it. a little bit about the co-op. I'm going to just like fly through these slides really quick because I think that the discussion will be a lot more interesting and I want to make sure that we have lots of time for Q&A. But just a really quick highlight. So Frontier was founded in 1976. We are a member-owned co-op, so we are owned and democratically controlled by the 65,000 member owners that we have, who are primarily retailers who purchase our products and then resell them in their stores. So like New Pie locally would be a member owner of Frontier. We have about 580 employees across four facilities in Iowa, and about 100 of them are around the United States in sales positions and other remote positions. We receive in raw materials from around the world at our North Liberty location that you've probably seen right off of Penn Street on that exit. And then after everything has been processed in North Liberty, we send it over to Norway, which is where our headquarters is. It's also where all the bottling happens, the packaging happens. And then everything gets sent over to Belle Plaine, which is our distribution facility. Our fourth facility is in Urbana, just north of Cedar Rapids, and that's where our personal care brand, Oracacia, is held. I mentioned that we're a co-op. I'm happy to talk all about co-ops because I'm very passionate about them and all of the socioeconomic change that they can bring. But it really has allowed us to live out our mission to nourish people and planet and to always be fair. And our purpose statement, doing good works, is really how we kind of live that out every day, which we'll go through here in a minute how that sort of parses out. But being a co-op is very much central to how we are able to operate in the way that we do, both because it allows us a certain amount of autonomy and independence, and it insulates us in many ways against some of the things that that corporations are facing in the world today. Our member owners fundamentally believe in the work that we do, and so it allows us greater flexibility to have the impact that we want to in the world. It also allows us a lot of the funding that was talked about in the intro, that $1 million per year, a lot of that can be funded through our membership. So it's patronage, which is basically dividends that co-op members receive based on their share of our sales each year, dividends that are returned back to the co-op to continue this mission-driven work. You know, it might be $50 or $150 or something to a store, and they don't want to break it all out and figure out how to divide it among their thousands of co-op members. So instead, they'll turn it around, send it back to Frontier, and we can use it for our purpose-driven work. Especially when you multiply that by 65,000 members, it ends up being a lot of money. Yeah, of course. Yeah, sorry. Is that better? A little bit? Okay, perfect. We do have three brands so that you would see in a number of different stores. So Frontier Co-op is obviously our namesake brand, natural and organic spices and herbs and flavorings in both a packaged format, and also we fill a lot of bulk sections you would see in like New Pie or Whole Foods, things like that. Simply Organic is our all-organic line of spices and herbs and flavorings and meal prep solutions. You see like simmer sauces and packets and things like that in that line. And that's in more mainstream, so you'll find that in Kroger's or Albertsons or Target here locally. But actually, all of our brands are in Hy-Vee and Fairway and New Pie. But anyway, that's the Simply Organic line. And then Oracacia is our personal care brand. So we do a lot of essential oils through that brand, some carrier oils and other personal care products. And we've also recently gotten into the natural air care space. So a lot of those products coming through there as well. So this is just really high level how we talk about and how we sort of live out our purpose day to day between these three pillars of purpose. So doing good works at source is what we're going to talk about mostly today. It's broken out between two parts, traceability and transparency and resilience. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it because we're going to spend more time on it here in a minute. Doing good works in our communities is really where all of that environmental stewardship and all of our giving live. So everything related to waste and packaging and water and energy usage and emissions and climate work, that all falls under there, along with that $1 million, which is broken out between branded giving programs, local giving, and some of our Well Earth dollars as well, which is a grant program we'll talk more about. And then Doing Good Works Within Our Walls also has two pieces. It's our benefits and culture, so just day-to-day how we interact with and our responsibility to our employees, and also our Breaking Down Barriers to Employment program, which is a whole separate talk for another day, if anyone wants to know about that one. But that is an award-winning program, nationally recognized, that includes second chance hiring, which is effectively ensuring that people who have a criminal justice involved background are not inherently or immediately disqualified from consideration for employment opportunities at Frontier. We have an apprenticeship and transportation program that works with in partnership with Willis Dady Homeless Services out of Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I say Iowa. I'm sorry. I give a lot of these talks, and they're not always in Iowa. we do have a subsidized childcare program. So both we have an on-site program in Norway, at our facility in Norway, that can serve up to about 110 kids. And we do a reimbursement program as well, subsidized reimbursement program, a number of other wraparound services to support parents. We've been Best Place for Working Parents, are on the Best Place for Working Parents list for the last 3 years. All of these things, I'm very fortunate to get to work with all the time. But today, I'm really excited to talk more about our impact sourcing program, Well Earth. So Frontier sources from over 50 countries around the world. I actually was already asked a question today about whether we source anything from Iowa. We actually don't source much from the United States at all. We certainly don't source anything from Iowa. It's hard to source the quantity and quality of herbs or spices from the Midwest, certainly. We do a little bit from the U.S. in terms of like peppers and, or capsicums, I should say, and like peppermint and things, but nothing from the Midwest area, a little bit of Washington, a little bit of New Mexico. But other than that, we source from over 50 countries around the world, which means a lot of responsibility when it comes to ensuring that not only does our business have a positive impact in those communities and with those supply partners, but that our supplier partners are having a positive impact too, socially and environmentally and economically, both with their own workers, with farmer workers, and also their communities as a whole. So our two key commitments to responsible sourcing really fall under these two categories. So traceability and transparency is the slightly drier one, if I'm being honest. It's where things like certifications fall. A lot of our quality assurance and quality control things fall through there, our testing and our full ingredient transparency. It's also where something called SEDEX lives for us. So SEDEX is a supplier ethical data exchange. It's a platform through which buyers like Frontier can collect information from suppliers around the world on their environmental stewardship and their social impact. Basically, suppliers who want to participate complete a supplier onboarding questionnaire, and they are given a score, and all of this is sort of shared publicly among anybody who is a member of the SEDEX program. So any new supplier that we want to sort of vet, we can go to SEDEX and try to find somebody, and we are able to see what their practices are around labor and their environmental stewardship before we ever even source from them. We are also able to onboard our suppliers into this program so that we can have better visibility into what their practices look like, and more importantly, areas, meaning commodities and countries considered high risk for things like forced labor or child labor, we're able to identify those through the platform and send and basically submit for what are called SMETA audits, so SEDEX Member Ethical Trade Exchange audits. So basically they're going, it's a audit that we would pay for. They go out to a supplier and audit their questionnaire to ensure that they were providing accurate and transparent answers. A little bit boring, I get it, I know. But the next part is exciting, and that's what we're gonna talk about today. So resiliency. So really, we've long recognized that in order for us to be successful long-term, it's critically important that the smallholder farmers, primarily smallholder farmers who make up our supply chain, are able to be resilient in the face of a number of different things, including climate change, geopolitical unrest, honestly, just market fluctuations, natural disasters, things like this. So we have created, in 2007, we created the Well Earth program, which is a grant program that funds projects at source with our supply chain partners to drive that resilience and stability at source. There are two parts of Well Earth. There are community building projects, which are more focused on addressing social issues. I'm excited to tell you guys later about this project we have in Madagascar. But we historically, these programs have included things like digging wells or building dormitories for kids to be able to go to school if it's further away, so they're not having to walk miles back and forth from school all the time. Access to medical attention, access to dental clinics, preventative care, things like this. On the other side, there's also business building activities, which are, again, critically important to the maintenance of our supply chain long term. So investments in things like infrastructure improvements, helping them purchase machinery, helping them meet certification requirements, helping them with food safety projects and trainings and agricultural trainings and things, just connecting them with the resources that they need to be successful long term. So our one of our more recent projects, and certainly the biggest project that we've undertaken, was actually, I'm not sure if it's going to play right away, so I'm going to try it. We'll see how it goes. Good, it didn't play right away. Okay. Was actually a project we just recently completed in really the activities were finished in August, but we finished reporting in November of 2024. And that was in partnership with USAID Cooperative Development Program. The project is called SPICE, so Safe Processing and Cooperative Enterprise, and it was really intended to help drive that resilience and stability with our smallholder farmer partners in three countries. This video gives you a pretty good overview of what those projects include, but I'm happy to talk more to them afterward. So, let's see. You want to go for it? Oh, okay, sorry.
फ्रंटियर कॉपरेटिव के मतलब उनके उसमें हमने बहुत मतलब उनसे हमने बहुत कुछ सीखा जब वो लोग आए हमारी बात हुई उन्होंने हमें हिम्मत दी आत्मविश्वास बढ़ाया कि आप लोग खेती मत छोड़ो करो तो हमने उनकी वजह से ये काम शुरू किया अभी हमारा बहुत अच्छा हो रहा है इनकम भी हो रही है हम चाहते हैं कि आगे को और भी अच्छा
El modelo cooperativo lo hemos visto como una herramienta de cómo nosotros como persona podemos desarrollar nuestras capacidades, cualidades como persona.
Where smallholder farmers are trying to gain access to the market, but the level of sophistication that's necessary, both in equipment, capabilities, business acumen, makes it difficult for those farmers. And that's where the co-op model really makes sense. With the help of the USAID Cooperative Development Program, we've been able to bring greater food safety technology to our Guatemalan partners so that they can do a better job of grinding, pasteurization, and getting that product ready for the US market.
Yo creo que el apoyo más importante que USAID nos ha dado es la parte de innovación y tecnología. Y eso, lógicamente, nos va a apoyar bastante para poder entrar en un mercado competitivo con un producto que viene del sector cooperativo.
We've been partners with FEDECAVERA for more than 15 years. We hold the same vision. The cooperative business structure is a force for good, that we can do great business if we work together. And we've gotten cardamom and allspice and turmeric from our partners for years.
Las personas que dirigen esta organización tienen esa visión de apoyar a los campesinos y buscar tratar la manera de ubicar nuestro producto en otra parte del mundo.
One of the best places in the world to get spices is Sri Lanka. From there, we'll get nutmeg, cloves, black pepper. One of the big challenges is meeting the Food Safety Modernization Act. So in 2011, the standards shifted from being more responding to a crisis to preventing problems. So the challenges that Sri Lanka was actually facing is the fact that it's very difficult to meet those standards. So we needed to make sure that training was improved, that food safety techniques were better in play, that there was all kinds of different pieces of that chain of control that really ensures the quality that we need in our products.
OSPP ව්‍යාපෘතිය යටතේ අපේ ඉදමත් යොදාගෙන අපි මේ වැඩ ටික කරගෙන යනවා. එයින් අපිට මේ ඇත්තටම අපේ අසන්න තත්ත්වය අසන්න හැම වැඩි බලදාවකට අපි ගියා.
I knew tea was important in India, but I had no idea how important. It's not just an economic driver. It's a cultural aspect. Through the USAID Cooperative Development Program, we've been able to take the resources that they've provided, along with resources Frontiers provided, and Young Mountain Tea and their growers to create a somewhat new business model to this area. That investment comes in the form of equipment for the plant, a new plant, training for the cooperative development, the farmers understand the power of that co-op, all the kind of aspects that it takes to run a good, successful business.
उससे फ्रंटियर कोऑपरेटिव से हमको फायदा ला रहा है हर महीने ट्रेनिंग में सीख रहे हैं सब कुछ फायदा हो रहा है दिमाग की सोच बढ़ रही है आपस में बोलना सीख रहे हैं झिझक दूर हो रही है सब इनके माध्यम से ही हो रहा है हमारा सब काम
We have a stated purpose in our company that doing good works, that you can do things in the right way and it will make your company money. I find it to be a privilege to be the CEO of Frontier Co-op and the opportunity to be able to partner with people in Guatemala, in Sri Lanka, in India, and to see the successes that these people have been able to obtain. They just need a little bit of help and we need to give them that help so we can get all their great products in return. Our consumers really do want to know how the product comes to them. By buying our products, they're actually going to help smallholder farmers around the world.
That's it for me. I think.
I've watched that video a lot of times. Yes. And I'm always amazed by the faces of the people. I think that just seeing the people.
Can you take this down?
Or? It'd stay, I think. Okay. I don't think our heads are in it.
Okay.
Yeah. Just seeing the people and their excitement and enthusiasm for what they're doing. So, Alicia, talk a little bit about, you went along on the trips to make the video. Talk a little bit about what you saw in each of those communities and how that represented the impact that these projects had on their communities.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm very biased because India was my project, so I'm probably going to talk the most about that one. But I will say, I actually had the opportunity to visit our partners in India twice on this project. The first time was in 2022, and it was the first time, maybe not even a year into this project. So the whole spice project started in 2018. But we didn't add India and Guatemala until 2021. We had an opportunity to extend. So in 2022, I go there, and most of the work that had been done at that time was very much bureaucratic. It was about setting up new entities and about getting bank accounts set up and figuring out, you know, a baseline assessment and figuring out a plan, basically, for farmer outreach and for what it was going to actually look like. There had been some engagement with our on-the-ground partners going out to the community that this first facility was supposed to be operating in, but the plant didn't exist yet. The new processing facility didn't exist yet, and so it was all very theoretical. And there was honestly a lot of distrust at the time because it's farmers are made a lot of promises by a lot of different people, and they have a tendency to not want to believe it until they can see it with their own eyes. And that is the same in rural northern India. There's also a cultural change there too. You know, a lot of the women were very quiet, and 90% of the farmers in this region are women, but the 10% of men who are there, if a man is present, the women will not speak. And so it was a different dynamic on that first trip. It was wonderful, and I loved every moment of it. The generosity of spirit that I witnessed there from every single person that I met was truly life-changing. Like, it made me feel, I'll never forget it. But it was definitely a different experience. When we came back out in 2024 to do this filming, I had prepped the team, the film crew, who were primarily men, and who were going to, this amazing crew that we work with is out of Guatemala, so we had like Spanish to English, English to Hindi, and then the women are actually speaking a separate dialect called Kumani. So there's a lot of different languages going on there. And I was like, okay, we're just going to have to be patient. And the days that we're filming with these women, we're going to have to just like sit quietly and like let them get used to us and let them warm up. And we're not, in order to get them to feel comfortable with us, we're going to have to like earn that space, right? To like make them feel comfortable. And when we got there, it was the exact opposite. They were like, what? Have you ever met these people before? But they were just so chatty and so excited about the project, and they couldn't wait to show me all these things. Blew my mind that they would even remember who I was. But they were just like excited to show us the new, all the things that they had learned, and they were just, yeah, they were excited about the facility because it was up and they were able to actually see it, even though it wasn't totally finished yet. And they had gone through all of these trainings about the co-op model, and they were chatting at me about it, even though I didn't understand anything that they were saying. And but it was just a night and day difference. I will never forget that feeling, and that it was just wonderful. It was a wonderful experience to get to see that transformation in them and the confidence that they had and the sense of inclusion too. I mean, there's nothing like money that proves like somebody should have a seat at the table. And in many cases, this is the very first form of income, of household income, that the women in those households were able to control, had any control over at all. And suddenly they are seen as like people who should be speaking up, and we do want to hear, you know, what your, like, their male peers do want to hear what they have to say. And there is more, I mean, I'm not going to say that it's 180 degrees, but it was darn close. And it was just really, I don't know, a striking change, and something that I certainly will not forget anytime soon.
Was it on the 2024 trip that you did the ribbon cutting at their facility?
Yeah.
So do you want to talk a little bit about that? Because there was a ceremony to really mark that occasion.
Yeah, there was a ceremony. So it's funny because at first I was disappointed because the processing facility was supposed to be totally finished by the time we got there so that we could film inside, we could see tea going all the way through. But as with any construction project, it just continued to delay. And it was supposed to be done like almost a year before we were there. And still, there are so many bureaucratic steps to jump through, and it's so complicated getting things into the mountains, and it's just a whole separate world that I learned a lot about. But the processing facility wasn't complete. In fact, there wasn't any machinery in the facility at all. The building was finished, but the windows weren't even in yet. And so at first I was disappointed, and I was trying to figure out, like, what are we gonna do? But the farmers and the plant manager, who is also a farmer, a tea farmer, had brought in some like chairs and tables and like a large rug, and we had this like wonderful ribbon cutting ceremony where they were so excited. There was like singing and dancing, and they gave us each shawls, and it was I cried more than I'm proud to say, but it was a really beautiful opportunity. I think the best things came out of things that just like weren't planned like that. Yes. And it was a really wonderful moment. Yeah, there are also full-length videos for each of the each of these projects that I think Peter is going to share with the group. And you can see more about the ribbon cutting and see more of the women sort of engaging in that space. But yeah, just blatant shout out. You should just go watch those videos because they took a lot of effort and they're really beautiful.
Just a quick question. Yeah.
Yes, yeah, it's up and running, and yes, exactly, yeah, it's good. No, it was up and running before we finished the evaluation and everything, so late summer of last year. But yeah, I haven't seen the final facility, so I guess I'll just have to go back.
I don't. I think you should. I think mm-hmm. one of the things that's so interesting to me about these projects is there's a lot of capacity building. So helping the small farmers develop the capabilities that they need to make this successful long term. Mm-hmm. And I know from talking with you, they also bring a lot of capabilities and capacities to the table. How do you weave those things together? How do you respect their kind of heritage and traditions while bringing in new ways of doing things?
Yeah, gosh, that's complicated.
Yeah.
And it also depends on where you're operating, right?
Right.
So in Guatemala, the partners that we had there, we've actually been working with for 15 years, and they are a second-level co-op made up of 42 grower co-ops underneath them. So they do all the processing, and they do a lot of other social and environmental and agricultural support, provide all of that support to all their cooperative member owners, totaling about 33,000 people. So honestly, with them, there was less about being prescriptive in terms of what they needed to do, and more, you know, once FSMA was passed, they just had some processing that needed to be updated, and it was more about connecting them with the right resources. When it came to like the project in India, it was a learning experience. Every week, it was, you know, something else. It's just like, you just have to trust me. This is just how it goes here, whether it's like bureaucracy and like different steps that we had to go to set up a foreign entity and to set up like how money was going to flow from the U.S. to India, and there's just some of like, you just have to trust me, this is how it's going, and it's gonna take a long time. And so there was some learning there, and there had to be a lot of flexibility in meeting our partners where they were at. But we got it done, and I think that's a very sort of tactical side of it. When it comes to the more cultural side of it, it also required a lot of patience and really listening to our partners because they are the experts. So the folks we were working with on the ground in Chimpawat, they aren't actually based in Chimpawat. It actually took them a 4-hour drive every time they went up there to go see these farmers. But they're a nonprofit in the area who's dedicated to women's empowerment. And they knew what it was going to take to work with this group of women to be able to get them to a place where they felt confident and they understood what it meant to own a business. They understood what it meant, what governance of a new business meant, what, you know, running the financials for a new business meant, and what it would mean to them to have, like, what ownership means from a financial perspective. So once you get dividends, what happens with that? And exploring the different things, because it is a co-op. So it's not exactly a co-op. It's a collective co-op. The co-op model has been used there in a way that there's not a lot of trust in co-op as a word, but it's a collectively held entity. So anyway, collectively, it was their business, literally, to figure out what they wanted to do with those dividends. And so helping them understand what that possibility looked like took a lot of time and a lot of them listening and bringing up challenges that the farmers had expressed in their meetings to the powers that be and trying to be the sort of intermediary between those folks. Huge challenge, and again, just takes time and patience and trust, so much trust that we had to have in them, and honestly, it panned out. It really did. And honestly, having them build that trust with the farmers on our behalf and on the project's behalf was another thing. So I guess partnerships, trust, and time.
Yes. But each of these locations, as you've alluded to, are different. There's different challenges. There's different capabilities. Mm-hmm. And Sri Lanka was one of the locations that started early, I know, before you came into the project fully. What did you learn from that location that you then were able to apply when India came on board?
Oh, gosh. Well, first, patience. So with Sri Lanka, definitely our most complicated project. And in transparency, it did not end up the way that we originally planned it. In fact, we have a great case study that the University of Iowa did for us. So if you want to read more about it, you are welcome to. It is a public document through USAID. But so we started the project in 2018. And in those first 3 years, we realized how much red tape there was going to be in order to establish a foreign entity there, because originally it was going to be a joint entity between Frontier and the farmers there. It was going to be a brand new processing facility similar to what we did in India, but for processing nutmeg and black pepper and cinnamon and cloves. But in order to do any of that, in order to set up a bank account, in order to set up a joint venture especially, you have to ask for all of these different approvals through the Bureau of Investment, which takes a long time and a lot of relationship development to be able to get anything through. And even when you get all of these theoretical entities set up, you still have to get approval for getting the actual, you know, permitting for the building and for all these other things. So many steps there. In the middle of all that, a global pandemic happened, which wasn't great, right? There was also in Sri Lanka a year of, or more than a year, but specifically in 2022, serious economic unrest and political unrest that had to be navigated. There was a full change in administration in that time, which meant all the relationships that we had developed had to be started over. It was just so much, and so I think seeing all of that, we came into specifically India and the idea of another new facility. This one was never going to be owned by Frontier, so it was a little bit simpler in that way. But we came into it with eyes wide open about, like, okay, so this is everything that we saw with Sri Lanka so far, and this is how we had to pivot. How do we make sure that that doesn't happen again? And I think in the end, you know, there's no amount of preparation that can ready you for the amount of time simply, and that, you know, we had to wait for things for every single step to get through, like, the Indian government as well. But we learned to run things in parallel paths. So we were able to run all of the social side and the outreach side and the training and the ag outreach and all the development work that needed to be done with the farmers and that trust building. We were able to run that all alongside all of the red tape stuff that we were all tied up in. So our meetings were very much like half and half. Just half was like a bureaucratic nightmare, and then the other half, it's like, okay, now it's our nonprofit partner's turn, and tell us about all the good things that are going on and all the different ways that things are working. But even that, like I said, took trust building and time.
But that structuring of parallel paths, I think that's so interesting. So I don't know about your new project. I don't know about Madagascar. So tell me about what you're working on now. These projects wrapped up a little less than a year ago in Guatemala, Sri Lanka, and India.
Yep.
And now you're moving, well, you had already started the Madagascar project at that point.
Yeah. Yep. So we always have a few different sort of irons in the fire with Well Earth projects based on strategic partnerships and basically reaching out to them, you know, to say if, you know, we were to provide funding, what type of, you know, social or business building projects would you have lined up? Because what we really want to make sure is that once we take our hands off of a project, it can continue to run without us. So we don't ever want to come to a partner and say, hey, we want to do this project in this place, because it will not work. Rather, we really take that sort of non-prescriptive approach to ask them, what do you need? What do you realistically have the resources to continue? You just need the investment, basically, to get you off the ground. So we have projects in Zimbabwe and Ethiopia and Egypt right now. But the project that Amy's referring to is one I'm very excited about. It's actually been going for a few years. In Madagascar. So Madagascar is a critically important country of origin to us because it's where 80% of the world's vanilla comes from, which is a very important commodity to Frontier. And vanilla is a very volatile commodity as well, globally. vanilla orchids. So vanilla is harvested from the only edible orchid in the world. And those orchids have to be planted and pollinated and harvested and cured and sorted and all these things by hand. So it's very labor intensive. It takes a long time. Once you plant a vanilla vine, it takes 3 years to mature. So it's not actually until the fourth year that you actually produce a vanilla bean that is viable. And it's not until later than that that it gets to be a really good quality vanilla bean. In the meantime, global supply and demand for vanilla is just like up and down constantly because there's a huge glut and then prices crash. And so then all of these vanilla farmers are ripping out their vines because they can replace it with something else that's more valuable. And then you start the whole process over again. Then there's no vanilla and then everything is super expensive. And so they're planting vanilla again. Add to that, the Sava region, which is where most of our vanilla comes from, and actually generally in Madagascar, very prone to natural disasters. And those are getting increasingly more intense and increasingly more frequent. And so there are times where a cyclone will wipe out an entire crop, or 30% of a crop, or 50% of a crop, whatever it is, it affects the global level of the global supply of vanilla. So it's an incredibly volatile commodity. In the meantime, all of these smallholder farmers are experiencing that volatility real time, where they have literally more money than they know what to do with in some years, and they are like stashing it or buying things that they don't want or need, but just want to get rid of the money and have something to show for it. And in other times of drought and famine, they're, you know, unable to feed their families, they're experiencing intense food insecurity, and it's just this terrible like cycle that just happens over and over and over again. So two years ago, we started a three-year project with our partners there to try to figure out how we can drive resilience and stability for these farmers. And it's a twofold project that's actually been going really well, and I'm excited to be able to go see it in October of this year, hopefully, fingers crossed. But the first side of it is a regenerative agroforestry program. So basically, crop diversification to include multiple cash crops, not just vanilla, but also vetiver, which is a commonly used fragrance product. Vetiver. Also, comestible crops are critically important to this. So they're growing, basically the idea of agroforestry is you grow a border of trees that could be fruit trees or they could be hardwood trees, or a variety of other sort of cash crop type of trees that surround your plot. And we're talking less than 2 hectares here. So small amount of land, less than 2 hectares is what defines a smallholder farmer. And then in between there, you're growing, vanilla grows as a vine, so it grows up those trees. In the middle of that, though, you've got lots of room for comestible crops. So you've got root vegetables, things like yams and sweet potatoes and manioc. Then you've got, you know, bananas and citrus trees and things like that growing around the outside. You've also got sort of staples like beans and other legumes and corn. So all of that to drive both crop diversification for income diversification, where they can sell some of that comestible crops locally and also feed their families and their community, and also income diversification through multiple cash crops to try to mitigate some of that impact. On the other side is around financial stability. So it's education around what are called VSLAs, or Village Savings and Loan Associations, which are effectively financial co-ops, like a credit union. So it's all owned locally. Everything is, all of that savings is maintained locally, and they make out small loans, typically no more than 3 months, to small business loans, basically, to their neighbors. We learned very quickly that we should not be making investments in the bank itself, in the VSLA itself, but only from the training, because people are much more likely to repay loans when they're to people that they know and they're to their neighbors. So they have been extremely successful so far. In year two, the average savings for each of those VSLAs was around $4,000, which is huge for these communities. And they are continuing to make these microloans out that are bringing in more income for the investors, the people who are putting their money into those savings programs, and also allowing for small enterprise. So if you want to create a new, you know, do some sort of processing with corn and you want to be able to sell that corn at market, but you need the piece of machinery to be able to actually mill it in your house, you take out the small loan from your VSLA, return it within 3 months with interest, and you're able to have your own small business, and everybody that you borrowed from has between 25 and 50% return, which seems steep, but they are small loans, and this is sort of the way that they're structured. But I'm super excited about it. Sounds boring, but it's a very exciting program.
No, it doesn't sound boring at all. I think it's exactly what I needed today, actually. I could sit here and listen to you talk about this more, but I want to make sure if there's questions from the audience that we have a few minutes. Does anybody in the audience have a question? And I'm not sure. Are you going to come to them with a mic?
Yes.
Oh, Sunday so, will come to you with a mic if you have a question.
If you have any questions, just raise your hand and I would bring the mic.
Hi, my name's Sade. I'm a student here at the university, a senior in the International Studies program. I was just wondering how the recent tariffs are affecting business, especially since I saw that China is one of the countries that you source from.
Yeah, excellent question. If you have somebody who has figured it out, please send them my way. We are honestly, our team is still identifying the extent to which that this is going to impact the company financially and what our plan to address that is going to be. I don't have anything firm to commit to right now, but it's a good question. Very reasonable question.
This is another question with things going on currently in the U.S. What's happening with the changes and the cuts to USAID? How is it going to affect your programs?
Yeah. Also, very good question. So our USAID CDP grant wrapped up officially in November as planned. So it wasn't early or anything like that. We don't currently have or plan to pursue any other USAID or US funding or federal funding in general. We didn't really have that in our plan. This was the only grant that we have ever taken on that was certainly of this size. It was a $5 million grant, but also with federal funding. And honestly, it came with a lot of strings and a lot of paperwork. It was definitely a different experience. It was a wonderful experience, and we learned so much, and it allowed us the flexibility and ability to have a much greater impact than we ever could on our own. But it was something that we were already planning to kind of take a step back and look at how we would manage internally in the future if we were to reapply for more grants, and we just haven't done so. So all of that to say, it actually hasn't had any impact, and I don't believe will have any impact on Well Earth, because we had wrapped that up already.
So I guess that's a good segue to my own question, which is sustainability. Because mm-hmm. with USAID's funding, after the funding goes, what happens next, right? So can you share with us the number of women that have taken this further beyond your initial input to sustain the small agro farms that they have, and they keep supplying your factory, and they are self-sustaining, and they're able to help themselves and their families. Do you have any metrics for those?
Yeah, so on the India project, it is still the first cohort of 50 women. The processing facility has been up for less than a full year. It hasn't even gone through a full harvest yet. They harvest actually in April, so right now they're going through all of that. The goal is, though, within that community, if it were to be scaled out, that one processing facility could benefit up to 500 farmers there locally. And regionally, if it was replicated, which was the idea, we basically build the pilot, we prove to people that it works, and then they bring people out. Regionally, it could impact up to 6,000. And again, only 90% of them are women. So not exclusively women, but a large portion. When we're talking about the Madagascar project, that is a great example of sustainability because we are a couple years in now. We have seen, so basically it's like a train-the-trainer model where we train lead farmers, and then those farmers train their neighbors and anyone else who's interested in participating. So currently, From year one to year two, we went from 15 lead farmers to 30 lead farmers and 60 follower farmers who are now in year three going to be moving into that lead farmer role, and then that will continue to expand out. So that is one that is really, truly self-sustaining. I think TBD with India, I sincerely hope to see it continue to grow, but I think they're going to need a couple of years under their belt before they start continuing to outreach. Yeah, of course.
I just had a question. I had an opportunity to spend a couple weeks in the Comoros recently, an island nation between Madagascar and the African mainland, with a Mandela Washington fellow who had been here in Iowa City. And they grow a lot of the same crops that are grown in Madagascar in terms of vanilla and the cloves especially. And I heard a lot of issues of crime there in terms of farmers that have to pick their vanilla long before it's ready because otherwise it gets stolen. Heard that a lot. Farmers that are kind of culling their cloves at night in the dark because if they have it out during the day, people come and take it. They can't leave it out during the day. They have to move it from place to place. I mean, just a lot of just issues that you hear about from individuals. And I was just wondering if that's something that has affected your work or that you've heard about as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
And obviously, a lot of it is motivated by the higher price that international payers will pay for these kinds of crops as compared to local markets.
Yes, that's an excellent point, and it is something that we do, the farmers that we work with do experience. Theft is a huge issue. We have heard reports of farmers hiring armed guards to like watch their plots of land. And again, it is, as you mentioned, driven by that very volatile market. So when vanilla pricing is way up, we're seeing farmers pull their beans early, which brings the quality down, which means it doesn't necessarily meet our quality standards, and that's really how it has impacted us historically. But theft is a huge issue. Also, adulteration is a huge issue that they don't face immediately, but it affects them down the road. So just based on, you know, people buying adulterated vanilla versus pure Madagascar vanilla. So just blatant shout out for that. If you have the opportunity to buy pure Madagascar vanilla, you should do so. They cannot say that if it is not 100% pure Madagascar vanilla. So just be mindful of what you're buying.
I think we've got time for one more question.
I'm sure that there's a lot that the world learns from your staff in Iowa, but I was wondering if you have a favorite anecdote about something that with your own Iowa operations, your food packaging, your growing, that you've learned from some food culture somewhere else in the world.
Oh, that's a good question. Yes, I have to say, I was absolutely blown away by chai culture in India. I am completely in love. It is part of what made me fall in love with this part of the world. Again, it gets back to that generosity of spirit. Every single place that you go, everyone will drop everything that they're doing and they will make you a cup of chai. And everyone has a different, you know, different recipe, thank you, for chai. Some of them are more ginger heavy, some of them are more cardamom heavy, but it's a whole process to add all the ingredients and wait for this kettle to boil, and then you pull over on the side of the road and you have a chai, and whenever you go to someone's house, they'll give you a chai, and oftentimes they'll have little salty snacks that are called namkeen or little cookies or something like that. And every place you go, it's that sense, that hospitality, and that sense of just welcome that I have never experienced anywhere else in my entire life. And I just can't explain enough what it feels like to feel that generosity from every single person that you meet along the way. And okay, Delhi's insane. Delhi's a little bit crazy, but get out of Delhi and get into the mountains and everyone you meet is just, it was an incredible experience. I wish I could make chai like that at home. I know in theory you can, but I can't.
Well, thank you so much, Alicia and Amy, for this excellent discussion. Can we just give them a round of applause? So we hope to see you all on Thursday, the 1st of May at 6:30 p.m. in the Schomburg Auditorium at the University of Iowa Main Library for our next program titled Reclaiming Heritage, Leadership in Restitution and Repatriation in Iowa. Thank you so much all for coming for this program, and have a good evening.